It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We dig into the origins of white supremacy and its grip on America now. Call in with your questions about white supremacy, about racism, past and present. Share your experiences, any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Mura is a writer, memoirist, poet, and performance artist in Minneapolis. New book is called The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths and Our American Narratives. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on the heels of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, what are you reflecting on this week of the holiday and commemorating MLK's life?
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about is how I talk about in the stories whiteness tells itself that at every point in American history, Black Americans have been at the center of our racial consciousness. They've always been on the right side of history. And yet, at no point in the present does white America ever turn to Black America and say, you know, you've been on the right side of history in every racial question we've had in this country. Maybe we ought to listen to you. Maybe we ought to follow your lead. That never happens. Similarly, we will celebrate. Even Donald Trump celebrated Frederick Douglass, although one got the feeling that maybe he thought Frederick Douglass was still alive. But even conservatives will quote Martin Luther King. But what they don't admit is that there can be equivalent of Martin Luther King in the present raising questions about racial justice. They will only celebrate Black heroes of the past, deny the possibility of Black heroes for social justice in the present. So those are some of the things I'm thinking about in terms. And then, as you said in the introduction, the idea that America began with two goals. I'm a storyteller. In a goal, you know, when you tell a story, you have a protagonist with a goal. So the first goal was freedom, equality, and democracy. But there was a second goal, which was the maintenance of white supremacy and the ability of white people to oppress people of color. And we're fine with telling American history through the lens of the first goal, freedom, democracy, and equality. We're not fine with telling the story of America through the lens of the second goal, which is the establishment and maintenance of white supremacy.
Within these stories, can you explain how you view whiteness with a capital W, what that means in terms of these beliefs and these practices of white identity?
Well, we have a very simple definition, ways of approaching race, which I argue are deliberately simplified. So whiteness is what I would say is an ideology. It's a set of beliefs and practices which people are taught and then which program people how to interact with other people in the society, how to think about what happens in the society, how to read and understand history. And so most white people are not really aware that they are taught how to be white in this society. And so, for instance, there's this Black theologian, Tandika, who did this sort of little informal survey of asking people she knew when they became aware of their racial identity. And I've done the same exercise with my creative writing students. And almost invariably, the students of color know exactly when they became aware of their racial identity. Oftentimes, it was some sort of talk that their parents sat down and gave them about what it means to be Black in this country, for instance. But the white people had to sometimes figure this out. And oftentimes, it was things like, I invited a Black friend, a Black girlfriend, you know, to my birthday party. And after she was invited to my birthday party, the adults told me, we don't, you know, bring people like that to our parties. So people understand the rules to whiteness when they begin breaking those rules. And so And the ideas for whiteness are often held both consciously and unconsciously.
David Mura with us. Most recent book is a collection of essays. The title is The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Let's explore a little bit of your background. You write about being a Sansei, third generation Japanese American. How have your experiences, as you talk about, you know, people's initial experiences, what about your life? How has that informed your writings on race?
Well, my position is not very well known and is a complicated one. My grandfather came here to America in 1898. So my family has been here a century and a quarter. I'm still occasionally asked where I come from, right? Mm. Or where did I learn how to speak English? But my parents' families during World War II were imprisoned by the United States government because they suspected the Japanese community held fifth column activists or potential. Now, at the time, what people didn't know was that the FBI had determined that the Japanese American community was not a military threat. And they lied to the public. The Solicitor General lied in the Supreme Court about this. And this was discovered only 40 years later when the government finally made an apology to the Japanese American community. Now, my parents' reaction to this community, and they were 11 and 15 at the time, they had committed no crime, obviously, was both consciously and unconsciously was that their race was their crime. And so they tried, I think, consciously and unconsciously after they came out of the internment camps to assimilate into a white middle-class identity. And they raised me in that way, not to think of myself as a Japanese American, not to think of myself as a person of color, but to think of myself as an American. And when I was in high school, a white friend would say to me, I think of you, David, just like a white person. I would go, that's great. That's, I want to be accepted. That's who I want to be. And so when I write in my book about whiteness, it's not something which is foreign to me. It's something which I grew up with, which I studied, and which I both consciously and unconsciously imitated. And it was only in my late 20s when I began reading Black authors that I finally admitted to myself I was not white. I was never going to be white. And in my writing, I needed to begin to explore what it meant to be a Japanese American. And I only found the language to talk about this, not in white writers, but in Black writers. Hmm. And then I began reading other writers of color, and I developed and explored the language to talk about my racial and ethnic identity that I had not been given by white culture, the white literature that I'd studied.
What are those parallels do you see from, as you talk about the Japanese-American internment camps of World War II, how does that carry over to today with anti-immigration sentiment or xenophobia? Can you draw some connections?
Yes, because if you're Asian-American, there's a way in which you're never quite considered an American, right? So people will ask you where you're from. And there is also a way in which you can be put in a category of dangerous or suspected foreigner. And this happens anytime there is trouble between a country in Asia and America. And it doesn't matter whether the country is Japan or Vietnam or Korea or China, this cloud of suspicion, this sentiment about you're not a true American arises for every East Asian American. You know, you could be a Filipino, you could be a Vietnamese, you know, and the sentiment could be, as it was in the last couple of years during the pandemic, anti-Chinese. And of course, if you're a Chinese American, you could be seventh or eighth generation Chinese American and have nothing to do with China, and yet people will still associate you with China. And so in the last during the pandemic, Asian American hate crimes rose 150%, and there were news of attacks of Asian Americans all over the country. And this wasn't helped by President Trump calling it the Kung Flu, or the China virus. And people just automatically then associated the virus tended to with Asian Americans, and again, no matter their ethnicity. And that happened during World War II, where my parents, who were thoroughly Americanized, I mean, my father actually voted for Trump in 2016, but they were suspected of being loyal to the Japanese, and of course, none of them were.
David Murrah, new searing collection of essays on race in America. It's called The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself. Call in with your questions about the persistent trauma that is racism. Share your stories, your experiences, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dive into the origins and lineage of whiteness in America and how white identity shapes history and knowledge as we know it, while Black history and Black viewpoints have been silenced. Call in about racism, past and present, 800-642-1234. David Murrah is the author of multiple books and poetry collections. His new book is The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself. David, your book starts with the death of Philando Castile in 2016. It ends with the murder of George Floyd in 2020, both men killed by police officers near where you've lived since the 70s. How have these tragedies affected you?
Well, I live not 2 more miles from where Philando Castile was killed. I've driven down that road several times. I've even received speeding tickets. And that road is known, it's not very sparsely populated. It's by the agricultural fields of the University of Minnesota. And it's known particularly as a speed trap, and that's about it. Now, when Philando Castile was killed, I knew people who knew him, and the death felt very close. And I, like many members of my community, was very upset by it. And I began I've been reading about race all my life and studying race, but I began looking much more into issues of the history of race. And what I discovered was after the Emancipation Proclamation, there was a question of how do you regard Black people, right? Because they would no longer be slaves. And one of the things that happened then was that in the South and also elsewhere, Black people could be arrested. And one of the things that happened during that time is there was a pseudo or false sociology, which was created and supposed to be specific, which believed and indicated that Black people were more inherently criminal than white people. And the intellectual sleights of hand that they achieved to do this are so obvious to us today, but they were not to the 19th century. So that an individual white person who committed a crime was regarded as simply just an individual white person. That person didn't cast any stain or any set of beliefs on what white people were like.
On
but
a larger
every
group
black
of community.
Crime was regarded as an indicative of black character, who black people inherently were. And so that ideology, that set of ideas still informs our society today. And one of the things that we make mistakes that we make about understanding race is we tend to define racism in a very simple way. If you are actively expressing prejudice or hatred or animus, if you have proven, absolutely proven and written down, like I discriminate against people of color when I hire, right? That's the only time that racism exists. Now, this is not the way racism works in our society. First of all, you have a larger group of people who actively do have these views, but know they should not express them in public. Then you have a group of people who would have what is called implicit or unconscious bias. And what this means is that people can consciously profess to believe in racial equality, and yet their behavior is constantly racially biased, and that they're not aware that their behavior is consciously biased. Now the thing is that Black people and white people smoke marijuana at the exact same rate. No difference. But Black people are four times more likely to be arrested for smoking marijuana. They're far more likely to go to trial than white people. They're far more likely to be convicted of the same crime. And they're far more likely to serve prison sentences, and they're far more likely to serve longer prison sentences for the same crime. So this implicit bias, and one would really have to believe that, you know, it's not that every judge or lawyer in the system is a member of the Ku Klux Klan. But this bias manifests itself in statistical changes, statistical differences between the way Black defendants or Black citizens are treated than white citizens. And then when you move to the healthcare system, where there are, again, great disparities between Black patients and white patients. For instance, in emergency rooms, Black patients wait longer for the same injuries or conditions for pain medication than white patients. They receive less pain medication than white patients for the same conditions. Now, in 2016, in this wonderful book, Under the Skin by Linda Villarosa about the healthcare, she mentions that a study was done of medical students in 2016. And half of them believed that Black people felt less physical pain than white people. Hmm. Half of them. Can I just finish one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
And the idea that Black people feel less pain than white people was something that Jefferson said. President Thomas Jefferson said in the 18th century. And so when people say the past, forget about the past, this very idea that Black people feel less pain was promulgated by our third president. And it exists in half of the medical students in this survey in 2016. So the past, there's a direct connection between Jefferson's ideas and the way Black people are treated in emergency rooms.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. David Mura, talking about misconceptions, racism, slavery, whiteness, who's a writer, memoirist in Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Circling back for just a moment on the justice system, and you address really how dash cams and bystander cell phone videos have really proven critical in contradicting police reports. How do you view information from police reports now?
Well, we view them now with skepticism. But part of the point of my book, The Whiteness Tells Itself, the stories whiteness tells itself, is that white people have always believed the stories they make up about white people. And they believe that their stories are true, objective, valid, official. And that any stories and narratives that Black people or other people of color have about their experiences are always questionable, subjective, unofficial, and untrue and invalid unless white people say it is. So the judgment of knowledge always invokes white supremacy. And so when Black people have been complaining about treatment of the police ever since they became citizens, but white people only began really listening to Black people, not when they heard Black people say, "This happened to me," but when they saw it in the dash cams and in the cell phone videos. And at that point, white people go, "Oh, maybe Black people have been telling the truth about all of this." And so it's not so much that white attitudes change, it's just that technology caught up with racism.
Hmm. And has that changed a lot? Do you feel like that has made a difference? I mean,
it certainly has made a difference, because obviously in George Floyd, had there not been a cell phone of that incident, the police report, which, you know, Chauvin would have said, like, subject, we resisted, we restrained them with our usual tactics, and the subject, George Floyd, suffered, died probably from previous medical conditions or the drugs that were in his body. And nobody would have known what the actual truth was.
I'm going to jump in here. David Mura, writer, memoirist, poet, playwright in Minneapolis, new collection of essays about white supremacy, how white people can better acknowledge the true stories and experiences of Black Americans. 800-642-1234 to call in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how white supremacy is being maintained in America. Author David Mura asks this question, why doesn't America value Black lives? Join in with your questions, your thoughts on race, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Celia in Madison. Celia, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, I'm enjoying Dr. Mura. And just like to add, my research on the Civil War indicates that you really can't separate class from race. And according to the book Albion Seed, Virginia during the English Civil Wars was in good part settled by English aristocrats and gentry such as the Washingtons, the Paytons, the Randolphs, and in the Hill region, the gentry, Calhouns, Henrys, et cetera. So at some point, some of those slaveholders likely had some Black slave children, such as Jefferson did. And therefore, the irony of the race issue is that percentage-wise, probably, more African Americans have a chance of being aristocratic than many whites do. And so the reason that many of the whites, obviously the poorer whites, were on the upper class side is because they knew they weren't at the top of the social ladder, but at least African Americans were below there, and they intended them to keep that position.
Celia, I appreciate you calling in. David, go ahead.
Well, I think this is true, and one of the people I deal with in my book, The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, is Thomas Jefferson. Now, you know, we don't want to consider the complete Jefferson. We want to consider the Jefferson who was a brilliant thinker, a brilliant writer, an inventor, an architect, the creator of the Declaration of Independence, you know, one of the chief contributors to our Constitution. But we don't want to consider that this man also held 600 slaves. This man impregnated Sally Hemings when she was 16. And she obviously had no choice to refuse his sexual advances. He had children who were 1/8 white who he kept as slaves. Now, and he kept the mother of his children in slavery and did not free her even after he died. Now, if I told you about this of a contemporary American, you would think this man was depraved, was a child molester. Now, yes, we have to consider the mores of the time, but if we only consider George Jefferson according to the mores of the time, we lose our moral compass. Because if you lower the moral bar in the past, it becomes easier to lower the moral bar in the present. If you don't look at the racism of the past and deny it existed, it is easier to deny that racism exists in today's society. And if you deny the fact that Jefferson was the leading, one of the, and perhaps the leading ideologist, the leading proponent of the ideas of white supremacy in his time, then you ignore the fact that in 2016, half of these medical students surveyed believed what Jefferson believed, that Black people feel less physical pain than white people. And that's not even to just those were the students who consciously answered that. There are probably a good number of those students who don't really consciously think that Black people feel less pain, but may unconsciously exhibit those attitudes because those attitudes are pervasive in our society. You know, so when I talk about whiteness in our society, I'm talking about not something that is inherent to white people, something that white people biologically possess. It's something they're taught. And it's ideas about the world, about who they are, who Black people are, who Asian Americans are, who Native Americans are, who Latino Americans are. And these ideas affect, and I would add, infect people's behavior.
You write about driving in Georgia, and you see this license plate that read, "If I'd known it was going to be this much trouble, I'd have picked my own damned cotton." What does that license plate tell you about this person's narrative around slavery?
Well, first of all, this person does not want the presence of Black people in America, right? Because the way Black people came to America was they came as slaves. Now, I don't think this person regrets the moral depravity of slavery. They just regret that there's still racial issues in the present. But what this person also, I'm sure, neglects is that, first of all, slavery was central not just to the Southern economy, but to the entire American economy. And there are many reputable historians who maintain that the wealth of modern America was built on the wealth created by slave labor. And they said, you cannot consider the way that the United States has developed economically as a nation without considering slavery. But beyond that, what the bumper sticker doesn't consider is that there were enormous existences of labor, of people thinking, not just physical labor, but people thinking, how do we justify slavery? How do we, you know, make sure that the distinction between Black and white is maintained? You know, and this person talked about that you can't separate race from class. And one of the ways it goes back to, say, Bacon's Rebellion, which is a rebellion of what we would call sort of a white working class in Virginia in 1676. And it was at that time when the white working class began to revolt. And they revolted in part because they wanted to attack Indians and expand westward. And the British were not allowing them to do that. That's when they began to really formalize the difference between Black and white. And what America has always offered white working class people is, we're not going to work to improve your lot, but we're going to work to make you feel better about yourself by saying you're not Black and that you are superior to Black people, to Native people. And we will give you the rights in 1676, you know, the rights of a citizen, you know, the right to own property. We will give you the rights of a free person, and that is dependent upon the enslavement of Black people. So that link between racism and the way that the ruling class has really gaslighted the white working class about why they are poor has been going on throughout our history. The person is talked about, the caller talked about slavery, and, you know, we've had this recent controversy about monuments, Confederate monuments. Mm-hmm. And there was this brilliant African-American writer, Carolyn Randall, who wrote an editorial, said, "You want Confederate monuments? My body is a monument to the Confederacy, slavery, and white rape." Those are the monuments that white America doesn't want to consider.
Talking about lasting impacts of slavery and white supremacy in the U.S. with author David Murrah. You can join in 800-642-1234. David, I want to circle back to implicit bias and implicit bias training, because, you know, that's certainly something that we have encountered in the corporate setting, in nonprofits, as we, as a nation and as organizations, work on DEI. What is possible through implicit bias training, and what can't it solve?
Well, it is shown that it's very hard to get people to give up unconscious bias. You know, they have this Harvard test, psychological test, you could take on online. And, you know, one of the things is people are more likely, both white and even some Black people, are more likely to associate positive feelings with white faces and Black faces. They're more likely to see an object that is not a gun in a white child's photo as not a gun in their hand. And they're more likely to see an object that is not a gun in a Black child's hand as a gun. Well, you can obviously see how this bias then manifests itself in police encounters, where police have seen objects in the hands of Black people and thought they were guns, and they weren't. So how do you read that? It is very hard. People have to go through training. People have to admit, you know, Donald Rumsfeld said there are known knowns and unknown unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
We all, every one of us in America, has unknown unknowns, things we don't know about race. And that's where we have to start the dialogue about race, is I personally may have pockets of ignorance of things I don't know. And that I am certain maybe about my beliefs. Like many conservatives are certain about their beliefs that racism no longer is a factor in American society. And maybe you hold that belief because there are things you don't know you don't know. And so people have to open their minds. And that's a hard thing to get people to do.
You also mentioned learning how to listen, not just listening, but learning how to listen. What might that entail?
Well, one of the things I think that entails is we have to listen to each other's stories.
Hmm.
And white America has a history of not listening to the stories of people of color, of regarding them as secondary, and regarding them as minor or unimportant or unofficial. And yet, as I said, the stories of Black people tell the moral history of this country, tell a great tale of spiritual strength, of courage, of independence, of a desire for freedom. And at present, we're in a state where this nonsense about critical race theories in the schools, and I say nonsense because critical race theory is a complicated legal theory that I, whom, you know, am very well read and who's gone to graduate school, have a hard time understanding. So they're not teaching that in the schools. Instead, what they're saying is, you can't teach, Tennessee, Moms for Liberty want to ban a book about Ruby Bridges. Now, Ruby Bridges was a six-year-old Black girl who in 1960 desegregated a New Orleans school in the face of a crowd of spitting whites with signs, jeering, hurling racial insults to her. And Moms for Liberty doesn't want to teach this story because it will hurt white kids. And I look at that and they think, do you think white kids are that fragile? You know? And also, why do white kids have to read that and go, oh, I'm a white person, I should feel terrible about being white? Why couldn't they read that story and go, this six-year-old Black girl was so courageous.
Mm.
She fought for her rights. I can take inspiration from this six-year-old Black girl. And so what they're really doing, these parents, is going, no, you six-year-old white girl, you can't identify with a six-year-old Black girl. And beyond that, they're not concerned about Black kids' fragility. They're not concerned that every single Black parent in this country must tell their children stories of police brutality and killings in order to try to ensure that when their kids go out in the school and they encounter out in the streets, when they encounter police, that they will be safe. These Moms for Liberty aren't concerned that, you know, they want to ban the story of the six-year-old civil rights hero. And yet they don't want to change the police departments so that Black parents do not have to tell their children stories of police brutality, police killings. They don't care about these Black children. So I think it's just nonsense. And it really is saying, we don't want to teach about racism because we want racism to continue to exist.
Author David Murrah, Unpacking White Identity Narratives Through Time. And you can join in, call in with questions about racism or white supremacy, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Minneapolis author and poet David Murrah, whose new collection of essays, they peel back the destructive narratives that enable white supremacy and racism to persist in America. The latest book is The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. David, we heard from Jean in Franklin, wrote in to say, I'm curious, why did the U.S. people decide to no longer want slaves? Jean writes, I don't think it was because people found it immoral, but because of economic reasons.
Well, I think it's a complicated thing because there was an economic rationale for slavery. Obviously, if you don't pay people to do work, your profits are going to be greater. That's just a simple fact. I think the thing about the Civil War, which people, and this has happened throughout American history, is we're taught American history, we're taught, okay, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by Lincoln. The slaves are free. 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment made Black people citizens. But immediately after, and the same thing in the civil rights laws of the late 50s and early 60s, was the idea was once the civil rights laws were passed, segregation ended. Well, after the Emancipation Proclamation, slavery did not end it officially, but it did not change the minds of the white Southerners who believed in slavery. The law did not change their beliefs, and it did not change their practices. And the whole history of Reconstruction and immediately after Reconstruction is a history of the South trying to reinstitute slavery. Now, what at every movement towards legal equality brings forth from a large portion of white America a backlash, which attempts to erase or undermine those legal advances. So there were apprenticeships in the South. And once you were apprenticed, because Black people didn't own land, they couldn't farm, once you were apprenticed, you owed your apprenticeship to the owner, the plantation owner, and plantation. Many of your, most of your rights were simply that of a slave because you couldn't leave because you owed them money. You had to buy goods from them. The same with different types of indentured farming. And then there were the Black codes, which said that any Black person who was not working for a white person could be arrested by any white person. So these Black codes said, any Black person who was not working for a white person, if they were not working for the white person at the time, they could be arrested by not just police officers, but any white person. What that means is Black people were inherently regarded as criminal if they weren't working for a white person. Once these Black people, and there were at least 100,000, Douglas Blackman says, in his book, and then you were in the slave labor system of the prison system. And at the same time, that was when the Jim Crow laws were established of segregation. It was when the Supreme Court ruled that although slavery was unconstitutional, racial hatred and racial discrimination were not part of slavery. And so they could continue to be practiced legally. And then you have the history of violence, which happened in the South after the Civil War, such as in Wilmington, where some people estimate up to 250 and certainly well over 100 Black people were killed. And this is a thriving Black middle-class town. And their section of the city was completely destroyed. They were run out. So all of these events were going on to reestablish many of the conditions of oppression in slavery. Similarly, after the civil rights laws were passed, we were supposed to have desegregated schools, but many school systems in the South are still as segregated as they were in the 1950s, except many of them are in private schools. So, you know, this idea that these things, that we've had racial progress, we overestimate racial progress and we underestimate racial backlash.
Let's fast forward to the present. You know, you say shaming people about racial misunderstandings is unproductive. What is the most productive way then to not have this slide, you know, as you talk about racial progress, you know, taking a step forward and then going two steps back?
Yeah, I want to open people's hearts and minds. And you don't do that through shaming and guilt. It just doesn't work. Human beings aren't that way. And so when I'm speaking about whiteness, I'm not speaking about individual white people. You know, I don't want to shame and guilt white people. I do want them to consider that maybe there are things about race and certainly the conditions under which people of color live in this country that they don't know or don't understand. And I've emphasized, you know, and we're doing this after Martin Luther King Day, that King believed in the power of love. And sometimes it's hard, you know, to love people who hate you. Some people it's hard to try to care for people who may hurl racial insults or have racist beliefs. And I don't think that every single person of color needs to encounter these people, but some of us do. And we need to be able to talk to them and say, I'm not here to destroy your way of life. I'm not here to denigrate who you are, but some of the ideas that you've been taught, they're just wrong. They're immoral, they're inaccurate, and they don't tell the truth about American history. And they don't tell the truth about me as a Japanese American or the Black Americans or Native Americans or Latino Americans. And so what I'm trying to give you is the truth. What you do with the truth, you know, is really up to you. But if we want to have a country which actually fulfills the goal we set out of equality, freedom, and democracy, we have to dismantle this ideology, these ideas, these practices of white supremacy.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
David Murrah is a writer, memoirist, poet, performance artist living in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis. His most recent book is The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths and Our American Narratives. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.